IPEP 2 will be able to address, or in those areas which they believe IPEP 2 may still need to review in order to address some of the challenges they have identified. But that's not all we want. It's one thing for us to hear about challenges, and problems. It's important for the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry to learn from you. You are the coalface. What suggestions do you have to address some of these challenges? It's so easy to identify the challenges very often. But put forward to us on the table how it is that we can resolve some of these. We may not agree with everything, but at least it's going to assist us in reaching a particular position at the end of the public hearings in this regard. So thank you to all members, and quite frankly, members know that the tea is always out there, so it's a matter of working tea breaks and that kind of thing, and we will proceed on that particular basis. I need to just make it clear to the Portfolio Committee that this afternoon, as we go through the apologies, I myself will be at an audit committee for Parmed, and I will be asking someone to take the chair at 2 o'clock. But other than that, the other apologies that I have is one from the Honourable Lyon, who is also addressing a very urgent matter that we are aware of. I think the witness is aware of that as well. We shall make the witness aware of the urgent matter myself. And then is there any other apology that we have? No. Yes, Honourable Kamala.
It's not a really an apology to say I won't be in a meeting for the whole program, but I need at least an hour to be out and say anything.
I think we do appreciate as members keep us brief. The main thing is to try to retain a representative body in the committee itself. I think all of us understand that. But if Honourable Maria, I'm sorry.
No problem. Myself as well. I've got a draft city appointment that is quite urgent, so I need to just go before that time as well. Thank you.
If we're all aware on that, we're going to have what is called a rolling tea break as well when it comes up officially, so that we just press on. Okay, and certainly we are very happy to all the members here, especially those who are stretched with serving on a number of committees. We really appreciate your contribution here, your active contribution. And I want to say at the outset, the Honourable Member Ndikelane is not here with us right now. I'm not sure of the reason, but as you know, he was in hospital, and he is now back with us and looking extremely healthy and ready to contribute. There are other matters that we also need to just indicate. Members, I want to make it clear that as and when the department makes me aware of their different, what shall I call them, outreach programs, different meetings, public meetings, if you like, and in particular on this occasion, the gambling commission, which they've set up, an independent commission, clearly members would like to know when they are meeting and so on. It was most unfortunate, and I have also indicated this to the department, because it's certainly the first time in my own experience as chairperson that we were not made aware of it timorously. In fact, I only became aware of it as I read it in the paper and not before. And I do understand, Honourable Maria, that you yourself were somewhat concerned when you only heard about this in passing, as it were, and then made your own inquiry. But in fairness to the department, they have kept us totally informed of every other matter, and I must thank them in that particular regard. And I understand members now have a full schedule, if I'm not mistaken, of that. If you don't have it, certainly our committee secretary now has it and will make it available to you. And as an ordinary member, you certainly, you know, South African, you have every right to go along to these meetings, yes. I'll take them in order. Shall I take the Honourable Van der Westhuizen, followed by the Honourable Maria?
Chair, thank you very much. Yes, we have received the schedule with dates and also the venues, but it doesn't indicate any time. And it's very clear to me that whoever organised this is not an experienced organiser of public hearings, and there still needs to be a lot of work needs to be done to really enable the public to attend these meetings. It's no use saying they will be today in Cape Town at so and so venue if you don't know, you know, are we starting at 9 or 11?
Thank you for that pertinent point. I will respond. Yes, Honourable Moret.
Thank you, Chair. I think you said about my concern that it was incredibly mild paper. I was actually very upset because eventually there was only 6 people attending that hearing. 4 were from the Western Cape Gambling Board, 1 was from the local casino, the other one was from the operators. So no single submission or representative from the community, from stakeholders, from interesting bodies. It means it was a total disaster and a waste of time and money, that exercise. Because I picked it up over the weekend on the news. Now, how would people in the local community know about that? And even if it's a day before the time, because the media briefing from the minister went out last Thursday, if I'm correct in terms of the date. Now, with all due respect, I mean, there was not time to advertise in the local papers. How do they operate? How do they go about? If this is the way that the Gambling Commission is going to work, my goodness, then they must stop immediately. Because then it cannot be a representative outcome that they will come and submit to us afterwards. Then they must stop immediately. Stop wasting time and money.
Thank you, Honourable Maria. Honourable Hadebe.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think that this commission still has teething problems. I think that it is good that we observe the problems which have occurred. I think what we can do, rather than saying that we must scrap it, it must stop, we will rather say that because the attendance in Bootsaw was not proper, let them organize another date to go back there so that those people who are interested in making the input there, they must really make it. And then amend, not even amend, insert the date on the email which they send us, the times in the email which they send us, so that everyone is transparent. Because it is our obligation as Parliament to ensure that whatever we do is transparent as possible. Thank you.
Yes, I think that this is the lesson, certainly for them, a very serious lesson, a serious oversight on their part. It is an independent commission in the sense that the minister has appointed a commissioner to run this. But at the same time, obviously we are concerned that the results of such a study are representative. And certainly a point already made about the dates. I'm not sure just if they've even been advertised already. And that should certainly be the case. They should be advertised. Certainly not everyone is on email, although the majority of South African operating organizations are. But the other matter, of course, is the issue of Worcester. Is it Worcester? Worcester itself. That I do think, certainly from the Portfolio Committee of Trade and Industry, that we would ask the Commission to seriously consider holding that public hearing yet again, because it certainly was not a public hearing. It made an absolute mockery of the concept of an open public hearing. And we would certainly urge the Commission not to repeat this kind of error again. Yes, Honourable Mabaso.
Yes, no, I think, Colleague Chair, you have touched on the vital points, and this is indeed a matter that needs our attention, and thanks that it has been brought to the committee's attention. But I would propose that we pass from this matter also want to make a note that this is, our committee is not a closed-in session, you know, where we have secrets. But at the same time, there are issues that we discuss in a committee forum. So that I think that this issue does not belong here, although there is nothing secret about it. So with those comments, Corporate Chair, I propose that we pass from the item. We should have discussed it, or we should discuss it in a proper committee meeting. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Certainly we are moving from it because I'm sure that they are already aware, as we have indicated. We're now going to come across to our agenda as it is. We have with us here this morning, 17th of March, not sure if there's anyone Irish here, probably in a festive mood, Professor Fiona Tregenna, who's from the University of Johannesburg, the Department of Economics. Of course, we're all aware there's so many different schools of economics, and I believe that you are dealing with developmental economics in this position you are holding, and financial economics. And she's coming to make an input from the University of Johannesburg itself. Over to you. We need to be more cognizant of time now. We're starting half an hour late, and we'll catch that up at tea time. If you can give us, I'm just informed you have a technical problem with the setup. All right, does everyone have the PowerPoint?
Well,
I'm sure Parliaments used to work before there was this kind of technology, so I see no reason for us to halt. So we are now going to move on. Straight away, we will follow from the actual laptop itself, the hard copy. So it's over to yourself to take us through somewhat briefly. We want to engage with you. So just focus on the highlights. You've been given each person half an hour. That means you really cannot speak for longer than 20 minutes. 15 to 20 minutes. Thank you. So if you can just refrain from the anecdotal information.
Thanks, Jefferson, and thank you for the invitation to come and give some comments on IPAC 2. I'm going to start by just making some general comments on industrial policy, and then more specifically on IPAC 2. I just wanted to spend a bit of time on figure out some of the arguments for why industrial policy. It may seem not that necessary in the sense that I think policy in the country has increasingly come around to an acceptance of the necessity of industrial policy. But I think there might not be yet sufficient appreciation of just how important it is in terms of scale and resources and so on. So in terms of the basic rationale for why industrial policy, I think one of the most compelling arguments is that there's not really any successful growth experiences around the world which haven't involved industrial policy, even when we look back in history. And particularly in terms of fast growth experiences have been associated with very strong state-led industrial policy. One of the basic arguments in favor of industrial policy is the market failure, that there are things which markets can't do, or cases where they allocate resources inappropriately and so on, and for successful industrial development, that needs to step in. Kind of linked with that is the concept of externalities and spillovers, that the actions of one company, one sector, one region or whatever spill over whether positively or negatively to others. And unless you have a kind of coordinated industrial policy, the positive spillovers can't necessarily be harnessed for industrial development, and the negative ones can't necessarily be mitigated. We can also look at the fact that economies tend not to adjust automatically in a structural upgrading sense. And what I mean by that is that adjustments which need to happen in order for industrial development and growth don't necessarily just happen by themselves. And this points to the role of the state and industrial policymaking in particular. In the absence of an active industrial policy, there's also a danger of a country being stuck in what we term a low-level equilibrium trap of low growth, low productivity, the types of goods are being produced being low value added, and so on. And it can just sort of trudge along like that for a while. And one of the main motivations for industrial policy is to kind of jolt an economy out of that kind of low-level equilibrium trap. Which I think to some extent characterizes what we've been in South Africa for the last few years, and to sort of put it onto a higher equilibrium. More broadly, I would refer to the need for structural change and the role of industrial policy in this. By structural change, really talking about structural upgrading, moving up the value chain, moving towards products which are increasingly in demand and have increasing knowledge content and so on. And again, for that, it's something which typically doesn't just happen by itself. If we look empirically and historically, it needs industrial policy for to succeed. That kind of structural change faces various costs and barriers, institutional stickiness, economic stickiness, and so on. And typically, you would need state intervention to overcome some of those barriers to structural change in the economy. There's also an issue of different time frames, but economic actors tend to make decisions, even if they're rational for that economic actor, with different time frames in mind. For example, a private company may be looking at short-term payouts of dividends or whatever, and may make an investment decision which is perfectly rational based on that. But in terms of our long-term industrial development and growth, may not be rational, and you need a long-term industrial policy to come in and stretch out those time frames. But a bit more specifically, we've got a huge heterogeneity amongst our different sectors in South Africa, in terms of their characteristics, how labour intensive they are, how aggressively they're able to pull along growth in the rest of the economy, implications for balance of payments, and so on. So this implies that you need an industrial policy which really takes account of those different sectors in terms of their needs for promotion and support, as well as prioritising different sectors because of their heterogeneity. A last sort of general reason which I would make for the importance of industrial policy is in terms of commercial manufacturing in particular. As we know, industrial policy is not only about manufacturing, but it is really at the core of industrial policy. And as I'll come to in a minute, industrial manufacturing is really critical for long-term economic growth. I wanted to show one or two empirical trends which are relevant to this just briefly. Here I'm just showing what is our manufacturing value added per person compared to some of our emerging Asian competitors over time. And what we can see is that although we started off with at least four times as much as manufacturing value added, we really just stood still while they've been growing. And here I've even excluded countries like Korea, which would be way off the chart and which would make us look even far worse. We can see over the last, let's say, 8 to 10 years, we're picking up slightly, but relative to our competitors like Malaysia, we're really going nowhere. To put it in the context of developing countries more generally in the world, this is showing our share of manufacturing value added as compared to other developing countries. So if we were on that horizontal line of 1, we would be keeping our own share of manufacturing value added steady as compared to those other regions. And what we find is that across the board, we're falling below that line of 1. So we're losing our manufacturing value added share relative to these other countries. Now, if it was just that we were losing it, let's say, against the rest of Africa, which is the middle line there, that wouldn't be so bad because they're at a low level of development, we expect some kind of catch up and so on. But the fact that we're losing dramatically against even other regions, for example, Latin America, there's been a huge debate over the last 2 years about what a sorry state their manufacturing sector is in, how terrible it is, how much more industrial policy they need, and so on. But we can see that even compared to Latin America, we're still falling behind, and compared to the world at large. So the real take-home message from this is that things can't continue as they are in our manufacturing sector. What we've been doing hasn't been working. And there really needs to be a dramatic change if we're going to, for one thing, even hold our position steady, let alone catch up. Now, while we're concerned about trends in manufacturing relative to other sectors, one point is that there's a lot of evidence in the economic literature that manufacturing is really key for long-term economic growth, and that the growth of your manufacturing sector in particular is more important for your long-term growth than growth in, let's say, your services sector, your agricultural sector, and so on. And generally, countries which have grown rapidly, when you look at startups, that have had a really healthy manufacturing sector. When you have a contraction in the manufacturing sector, the share of total employment or GDP, which is referred to as deindustrialization, this tends to be detrimental for long-term growth, and particularly where this kind of deindustrialization is happening in a middle-income country like ourselves, not in a country, or less so in a country like the UK or the US, which are already industrialized, where industry has already reached a much higher level of development. Another point about deindustrialization is that not only is it detrimental for long-term growth, but it's also really, really difficult to reverse. Once you lose some of your industrial capacity, it's incredibly difficult to claw that back. And this makes sense. I mean, even if we think of, let's say, a factory that closes for whatever reason, if the economic conditions that led to that factory closing change, such that it becomes economically viable for that factory to produce again, it's so much more difficult for the factory to rebuild its capacity, machinery, technological capacity, human capital, and so on, than it was to lose it in the first place. So one really needs to be careful of policies that allow for deindustrialization, because the industry concept is easily bounced back once it's lost it. Not only is manufacturing as a whole generally important for long-term growth, but of particular importance is the level of sophistication in manufacturing exports. The evidence suggests that the more advanced the country's manufacturing exports are, in general, the more rapidly it tends to grow and the more sustainable that growth tends to be. Businesses say that we can't just be relaxed about losing our manufacturing capacity or our manufacturing sophistication and think that we'll be taken by other sectors like services. Okay. First of all, this time, I could just jump over these historical lessons of industrial policy, because I'm sure things which people might be familiar with in their day. Let's just pick up on one or two key points. This is really some sort of best practice lessons from industrial policy over the years internationally. Not things that necessarily we need to take as a blueprint, but if we're going to do things differently from things which tend to have worked all around the world, we should be aware of it and know why. Some of the key points is that you can't just be satisfied with your current competitive advantage, that you need to move up and actively through industrial policy to develop more advanced comparative advantages. The importance of creating temporary monopolies, where a sector or a group of firms has a protected position for a period of time, but combined with management of rent, so that what they benefit from that doesn't just simply go into dividends, but goes into investment, into technological upgrading, and so on. First, let me just touch on the last point here, because it might be a bit controversial. Successful industrial policy around the world has been characterized by the acceptance that there will be some failures and there will be some wasted of resources. Obviously, this is within limits. But something where policymakers freak out, where there's something that fails, or a sector that's targeted that fails, or incentives that are given to a firm which are not used productively or whatever, and back off. May seem sensible in the short term, but in the long term, you need to tolerate those, obviously up to a point, if you're actually going to develop. Technology, I'm just picking up a few highlights here. Successful industrial policies around the world have had specific innovation policies within that, because of an acceptance that you need over time to shift to activities with a higher knowledge content. And that this isn't something that happens automatically, and that industrial policies actually need to promote technological transfer amongst firms domestically, and to promote the creation of new innovation capacity. The last point I'll just pick up on here is the importance of supportive macroeconomic policies, and particularly in terms of undervalued exchange rates and low interest rates. If we look at both successes and conversely failures of industrial policy, we generally find that in the successful cases, macroeconomic policies are shaped around being supportive of industrial policy objectives. Briefly, when we look at what could be the role of the state in industrial policy, we can think of it in terms of four broad roles. Firstly, as a regulator, and here we think about things like competition policy, but also things like tariffs, fiscal incentives and penalties, and so on. Secondly, as a financial agent, either directly providing credit or steering credit in particular directions, differential interest rates, and so on. Thirdly, as a direct producer of industrial goods. And fourthly, as a consumer, for example, through strategic procurement policies. And governments typically use a combination of these four. In IPAC, it focuses on three of these, less so on state as a producer, which could be, for example, to Paris Basel. So it perhaps downplays that aspect of it, but I think has the other three state roles in industrial policy. I've taken this chart from a United Nations research paper, and I find it quite useful in terms of thinking around different types of industrial policies for different types of sectors. They suggest that you've got basically three tiers of industrial policy. Firstly, horizontal policies, which really span across all sectors. And here we think about things like skills development in general, infrastructure, conducive business environments, and so on. And generally, those kind of policies require fairly low institutional capacity and involve a relatively small number of instruments. We then move to selective policies, which entail a bit higher institutional capacity and generally more and more sophisticated instruments. And here we think about things which are targeted at promotion of particular sectors. And then thirdly are frontier policies, which are really pushing the envelope in terms of targeting particular niches of production. In other countries it would be things like nanotechnology, biotechnology, and so on, which really need really sophisticated instruments, high-level capacity, and very clear targeting, technological promotion, and so on. In ACAP, it doesn't necessarily use this kind of thinking. It may be a useful way of thinking about it, but for example, the cluster three industries in ACAP, like aerospace and so on, might need the kind of frontier policies in addition to the horizontal and selective policies. And I think that some of the sort of toolbox of measures which the state needs to look at a combination of. What I would think would be some of the appropriate objectives for industrial policy in South Africa in general would be firstly, and quite obviously, to increase labour absorption given the high rate of unemployment. Secondly, well, there's a debate in South Africa as to whether we have actually deindustrialised or not, but either to avoid deindustrialisation or avoid further deindustrialisation and actually to promote reindustrialisation if relevant, and to put manufacturing on a long-term growth path. From the chart that I showed earlier, we saw how much ground we've lost in our share of world manufacturing value added, and obviously industrial policy needs to target increasing that share. In terms of the composition of products, we need to move towards what I term demand dynamic products. This is the kind of products which are increasing in their share of global demand, and of particular importance would be demand amongst OECD countries, which in general tend to signal the way that global demand is growing. And this is one of the things which, in successful industrial policies, they will actually study which kinds of products tend to be moving up in their share of global demand, and which ones tend to be going down or sitting steady. And if you tend to be producing in products which are not demand dynamic, then you can anticipate that in the medium to long term, you're going to have a problem in terms of the demand for your products, and that the price of your products that you can get in world markets is likely to go down. And industrial policy needs to explicitly look at targeting demand dynamic products. This is not quite the same as targeting sectors, because within sectors, you can have products which are more or less demand dynamic. Clearly, industrial policy also needs to support broad-based black economic empowerment, and particularly in actual production. And I think industrial policy actually provides a good opportunity for shifting triple BEE towards people's involvement in actual production, which is less the case in deals in the financial sector, services, and so on. Industrial policy also needs to promote diversification of our production and to support South Africa's objectives in the region and the continent. Just to come to some sort of more specific objectives, particularly at the sectoral level. Our network policy needs to strengthen our domestic linkages between sectors. Here I'm really referring to how much of the inputs of one sector go into another sector. I won't have time to talk about the empirical evidence in detail here, but what we're really looking at here is, in particular, the backward linkages. Where a sector sources a lot of inputs internationally, just points to some kind of scope for increasing backward linkages. And here we're really thinking about the pulling power of one sector on another sector. We need to specifically target sectors with desirable characteristics, and here I set out some suggestions for what those may be. Goods which are labor intensive, demand dynamic, which have positive, which generate a foreign exchange for the balance of payments, strong domestic backward linkages, technologically progressive, and which have scope for cumulative productivity increase. So here we're saying about products that its productivity can increase over time and actually build on itself. Now, of course, some of these characteristics can actually be in tension with each other. For example, some of the more labor-intensive sectors may be less technologically progressive. And this is one of the trade-offs that industrial policy needs to explicitly confront. I think our policies also need to discourage exports in relatively unprocessed form. This thing where we export steel and it comes back in manufactured goods with higher value added, we're really not going to go anywhere in industrial development like that. And the fact that those things are happening now suggests that unless there's a policy intervention, it's unlikely to change. Some of the constraints to successful industrial policy in South Africa. Firstly, the macro environment, I think, is one of the key constraints to industrial development and to industrial policy at the moment. Four aspects of this in particular. Firstly, the strength of the rand. As I referred earlier, the successful industrial policy almost always has an undervalued exchange rate. Also, the volatility of the rand, which makes planning for exports and so on more difficult. High interest rates. Obviously constrained industrial development, and also low domestic demand would constrain the size of the domestic market and scope for industries to kind of start off with the domestic market as a base before branching out internationally. In a way, although these constraints are in the macro environment also central, they're some of the more easy constraints to address in the sense that they're things which are more directly under the policy control of the government. And it's much easier to address something like macro than something more structural constraints, and it would take a longer time to address. I would say that our high unemployment rate obviously is a challenge for industrial policy, and at the same time, it's actually a constraint, and something which I think in the IPAP press needs to be taken more explicit cognizance of. This is in the sense that if we were sitting with a typical middle income unemployment rate of single digits, I would then be saying the kind of sectors which I think need to target is really high technology, highly progressive, even capital intensive sectors and so on. The fact that we have such high unemployment in South Africa means that we can't do that. And it limits our ability to target the kinds of products and sectors which tend to be highly demand dynamic, have high scope of cumulative productivity increase and so on. Well, it's not a linear trait, it's not that the more labor intensive ones are completely bad in other areas. But it does limit our capacity for targeting sectors that will tend to pull us along into the knowledge economy and high growth and so on. And it actually forces us to adopt a more mixed bag of activities to target. At least in the short to medium term, until unemployment is brought down. And perhaps this is a sort of tension that IPAP needs to confront. Infrastructure, I think, is well known, so I'm going to skip over some of these because I'm sure you've heard all about them. Concentrated economic ownership and control. The high cost of capital and also the problem with not only with cost but availability. Skills, the capacity of the state to implement the kinds of sophisticated industrial policies which we need and which our competitors are needing. I think this is not necessarily an argument against those policies, it's an argument to build up the capacity of the state in order to do what needs to be done. The limitations of our private sector, you know, when I compare, here I'm just talking in real generalizations, but let's say the perspective of much of the private sector in South Africa compared to in developing countries like Brazil. For example, in Brazil, you find that the private sector over many years has been very strong on things like the need for lower exchange rates, lower interest rates, and so on. It's something that they're very vocal about. When they meet government, this is at the top of the agenda. Now, it seems to see that in some of the hearings here, you find some of the groups of manufacturers raising these issues quite forcefully, which I think is a positive new development. But still, I think some of the apex business organizations don't necessarily push these issues, even though they're in their interest. And I think some of the positions of big business on these kinds of measures perhaps it may be more ideological than anything else, and it would be good to see them articulating policy issues which actually affect them directly, like around exchange rates and interest rates, even where there's a difference, let's say, between the industrial capital and financial capital, which may directly, financial capital may benefit very well from some of those policies like high interest rates, and even though they're detrimental to manufacturing capital. Productivity and competitiveness, obviously a problem. And finally, cost dependence. Now I'm really thinking about where you're on a path which has been on for several years, and you really need something to jolt us off that path. So you need kind of decisive policies, even like a sort of a big push, to kind of break that cost dependence, either at a firm level or at a national level, because you really can't be business as usual. When I say some of the strengths of IPAC, coming more to the detail of the policy, one is that it is a really detailed policy, it's very concrete, it's got quite measurable outcomes within the time frame, and I think that makes it quite useful. Even, for example, for the portfolio committee, a year down the line, you can call the DTI back and look point by point at IPAC and look at what progress has or has not been made in that respect. I think another strength of IPAC is in the recognition of the importance of policy integration, particularly in terms of micro-macro coordination. Also the leveraging of procurement for industrial policy objectives, the emphasis on developmental trade policies, the focus of IPAC on sectoral differentiation and targeting, and that it targets a range of sectors. Some people have criticized IPAC for targeting too many sectors. I think in a way, I mean, particularly given the dual challenge which I mentioned earlier, on the one hand, labor absorption, and on the other hand, moving up the technological ladder. So in some sense, we didn't have a choice except to target quite an eclectic mix of sectors, some which are going to be more important for growth pulling, some which are more going to be more important for labor absorption. The emphasis on the importance of competition policy, I think, is also positive. I think there's a three-tier clustering of sectors in IPAC is quite a useful one. And lastly, this is not so much the strength of IPAC per se, but I'll just comment that I think the sort of normalization of, to some extent, of economic policy debates in South Africa associated with IPAC is something welcome. And what I mean by that is that I think for many years, economic policy debates, particularly around industrial policy, have actually been quite to the right of similar debates in other developing countries. In the sense that industrial policy measures, which are sort of taken as common sense in our competitors, and that's something which is obvious but must be done, have, in the policy discourse in South Africa, been sort of viewed as some sort of wild, crazy idea that will scare away investors and so on. And I think that clearly this has been detrimental. I mean, the figures speak for themselves when you look at what happens in our manufacturing compared to our competitors. And I think it's positive that we now are beginning to catch up and look at some of these measures which are widely used internationally, not so much in an ideological sense, but looking at simply what works and what's necessary. The last thing I'm going to come to is there some other general comments, ideas, suggestions for things which perhaps might not be an IPAC or might need to be beefed up or whatever. Apparently, I think that we need a significant upscaling of industrial policy, and IPAC is a step in that direction, but we may need to go beyond that. When we look at our expenditure on industrial policy compared to our competitors, we still tend to be below what they are spending in terms of their budget or the share of their GDP. And particularly when we look at the fact that we've got lockdown to make up, we should actually probably be spending even more than our competitors on industrial policy. So I think I have to, the step in that direction, but may need to go even further. On the sort of time frames of IPAP, this IPAP 2 is put as a 3-year program, and it makes mention that the intention in the future is to move towards a rolling program of annual evaluation. I think that the 3-year time frame is really not long enough. I think it could be important as a sort of subset. You need a longer industrial policy, and in that, you need a 3-year program. Now, I realize that this IPAP obviously does rely from our broader industrial policy, and we do have some sort of longer-term objectives and so on. But I think that even in terms of an action plan, we need, let's say, a 5-year at least action plan, and then within that, a subset of shorter-term measures and reviewables. I think that the IPAP may need to confront more clearly the implications of our high unemployment for industrial policy. It does talk about our high unemployment and the need for labour absorption and so on. But it may need to think through more some of the trade-offs and tensions between what are some of the measures which may be needed for reducing high unemployment and for meeting some of the other industrial policy measures which are identified, because these don't necessarily all go hand in hand. I do have a concern about micro-macro policy synchronization in practice. Micro-macro policy synchronization. As I noted, I think one of the strengths of ICAP is that it does note the importance of macro-macro coordination. But when we look at some of the different policies which are coming out, I'm not sure that in practice that synthesis is yet there. I'm not yet sure whether the things which come out of the budget are necessarily sufficient to support industrial policy as we need it. So it's a bit difficult because I think some of those things are not under the direct auspices of IPAP, but of the government as a whole. And unless we have that, it could really destroy the success of IPAP. I would encourage the consideration of a tool of policy measures, looking at what's been used internationally, without ruling out any in advance. Look at what works and what doesn't work. Without saying, well, this doesn't look good, or they send the wrong signal, or whatever. I think IPAP may need clearer criteria for sectoral targeting. Some of the criteria are there, but I think that what would help is would be to have a list of criteria. I mean, I suggested some of them here in terms of standards of payment, labor absorption, backward linkages, and so on. And from those criteria, to sort of explicitly look at the strengths and weaknesses of different sectors in terms of those, which could help us to hone in on particular sectors for targeting. I mean, even within the range of sectors identified by IPAP, which of those should be priorities. I mentioned earlier the sort of asymmetry that it's very difficult to regain production capacity which has been lost. And perhaps this is something which IPAP needs to sort of take into account more explicitly than it does. When you don't prioritize an activity and there's a danger of being lost, you need to be really sure that this is something that we can afford to lose, knowing that it's going to be very difficult to get at that. IPAP does have a lot of the financial sector, and particularly on development finance institutions, which I think is very welcome. In my view, I think it could be a bit stronger on the financial sector as a whole, particularly on the financial sector, on the private financial sector, which isn't that much emphasized in IPAP. In what ways do they affect industrial development, both positively and negatively, and what are might be some of the measures in the private financial sector needed to support our industrial policy objectives? I think we might want to keep a bit of a closer watch on the current account balance. I think that the deficit on our trade balance is a bit worrying, and I would have liked to have seen a little bit more concern in IPAP as to how this can be addressed. It's not that it's silent on it. Obviously, it does look at improving the balance of payments and the way that different activities can improve this and so on, but I think it might need to be a bit more prominent. Something which is not part of our industrial policy measures at the moment, but which I think might be considered, would be from those four roles that I mentioned earlier of the way that the state can be involved in industrial policy. One of them was state as producer. Obviously, this is something which is already happening at the moment, that we do have state parent stakeholders involved directly in production. But it may be something that we would want to look at increasing. In a way, it's a kind of difficult argument to make, particularly given the recent problems in state-owned enterprises and so on. It is difficult to make an argument for setting up new state-owned financial state-owned enterprises, but I think that those problems don't necessarily negate the argument where it's there. And for example, where there are activities, manufacturing activities, which are economically feasible and which are not being carried out at the moment by the private sector, there may be a scope for setting up new enterprises, which can at least take those effect for the first 10 years and then hand over to the private sector. Kind of related to that a bit, but a bit different, is that I think there may be a scope for setting up some kind of joint government business research initiative to identify feasible manufacturing opportunities that are not being done currently in South Africa. You know, often I look at some of the goods which we buy here, which we import, and just wonder, couldn't this have been produced in South Africa in a cost-effective way? Now, in some cases, the answer probably is no. Probably it could be done more cheaply somewhere else, and we may not be able to compete. But I think in some cases, the answer may be yes. And we need to move away from a mindset that suggests that the fact that something's being imported means that it can't be done economically in an economically viable way in South Africa. It's not necessarily the case. And what some other countries do is actually to look at particular products and break down in detail the cost structure and say, how much would it actually cost us to do this? Can we do it feasibly or not? And what would it take to do that? Would it take some kind of technological support? Would it take a short-term subsidy if it would then make it economically viable after a given period or so on? And it's something that's quite difficult for government bureaucrats to do, but perhaps something which could be done jointly with business may yield some fruit. Because really what we're looking for is what are some of the other things which we can manufacture, particularly in terms of demand dynamic products, that we're not doing at the moment. And the very last point which I'd make would be the importance of coordination on policy areas that are necessities for the success of ICAP, but which don't fall directly under ICAP or under DTI or under the purview of this portfolio committee. Obviously, it's a bit of an awkward area in terms of policy coordination in government, but the fact of the matter is that there are policy areas which need to be changed in order for ICAP to succeed, but which don't fall directly under ICAP. And I think the fact that ICAP was released by the economic clusters is a good development in that sense, but there does need to be some sort of mechanisms within government for looking at those measures. And for example, even within Parliament, how does this portfolio committee, perhaps in conjunction with others, look at those policy areas which directly affect and industrial development and are actually prerequisites for the success of ICAP, but which are not directly under the responsibility of DTI. Because I think unless those are addressed, the objectives of ICAP are unlikely to be met. Thank you.
Thank you very much for a really very informative and enlightening input there, and also some suggestions you've made. Now, honourable members, we've had that 25 minutes input. We'd like the members, we'll take 5 hands max. Please restrict this to a minute. It's a question. A question, a clarification, or a short comment. Thank you. We are going to be taking the Honourable Kotsi Khadebe Mabasa. You can see how I'm just moving up here. Mabasa, Honourable Van der Westhuizen, Honourable Marie. Now that's a little bit more than 5. We're relying on you to keep it short. Honourable Kamala, you had your hand up and down. Was it yourself, Honourable Ntikelane? Because I won't be having a second round. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I also want to thank the speaker on that input. Her advantage is that she is an economist and is not in any business at the moment that would really have to listen. There is a saying that any policy does have two sides. If it assists on one hand, on the other side is absolute disadvantage. If you look at DIA, which was able to increase the capacity of South Africa in terms of economy, GDP, and paying our debt, but unemployment,
increased. What in this policy that we are formulating now will have to look at as parliamentarians to make sure that we try and overcome that? The issue of SMME, very little is said about it in this industrial policy. In your own view, how do you see SMME benefiting that? The SPF, in terms of the country, it is mostly where you find most of people employed and exactly where you find the labor intensive. Lastly, you speak about high tech and Lastly, you speak about the high tech and also labor intensive. Now, if South Africa is behind with technology and that it needs to move up with other countries, what kind of balance do we have to do as South Africa, because we've got an abundance of labor and that needs to be dealt with in terms of dealing with high unemployment in this country?
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. First of all, I'll also follow my colleague Mekosi in appreciating the input. It's very fresh and very broad indeed. The first question I'd like to ask here is, I can see that you have done comparative studies with other countries. Yeah. Can you mention only one country in the world which has industrialized without the state intervention? Only one. Without the state intervention. Number two, you spoke about the potential state role in the industrial policy. As you said, just like being a regulator, financial agent, producer, consumer. It's what I got afraid when I saw that. Because I expected that our government must be doing that, as you're saying now. They must be a regulator. They must be having some sort of a regulatory role, which they are doing. Né? And then what you also raised the issue of the government being a producer. I know that the state was a producer in the form of SAFA, in the form of ISCO, but they were advised to give to the private sector. Eventually, it led to uncompetitive behavior from those parasitas. For example, on the issue of SAFA, we are using our own coal, but we are paying the price of, as you said, all is coming from the Middle East. Also, on the issue of steel, we are using our own oil, but we are paying it with the steel is coming, it was sometimes the steel from China, it was cheaper. So, as a producer, you want to tell us that the state must reclaim back those parasitas which are producing, where they are producing. Number two, you raise the issue of the strategic protection. The state must play a role of a strategic protection to certain industries. It's true, yeah. But will that not go against the WTO resolution? Take for example, just like this ICEP we're having now, the Department of Treasury is complaining that if we're going to do some sort of point matching, yeah, between our local companies and external companies, that will be unconstitutional, that will be illegal. Is that one area where you say that we must review the policy, so that it can be in alignment for the success of this IPAP. Number three, we also spoke about the issue of skills. Yes, the skills are critical for the curriculum to go. But let's make an example from the university. This country is running short of engineers. But what is happening, the students will go to the university, train for engineering, but to get a qualification, they have to go to the voluntary association, whereby they are not even pushed by the university to produce, to ensure that these learners get experiential training. They do it voluntarily. That's why I was speaking now. Look at the number of mechanical engineers which are produced per annum. Look at the number of electrical engineers which are produced per annum. It's because at the university, yes, the theory is done, but volunteers have to do the job at the end of the pipeline. Do you think that we must change that policy also, so that we can produce the numbers which can sustain the economy?
Thank you, honourable members. If we can just restrict it to two questions per person, per member. Honourable Kovar.
Yes, thank you, Secretary. when you speak about the constraints to a successful IFA, you made mention of the problem of concentrated economic growth. Are you referring to the dominant, you know, the big dominant firm, cartel, which tend to suffocate the smaller emerging industries, SMMEs and cooperatives? And in most cases, these SMMEs and cooperatives would then be met to the periphery of economic development, of economic activity as a result of this concentrated ownership and value control. That's one. Two. On the question of the past dependence, to what extent is this linked to the single skill workforce instead of multi skill, lack of competition, and reluctance to invest for more productivity? And lastly, my apologies, Chairperson, just one very short one. Don't you think, speaking of skills, don't you think that it is time higher education, entities, and the private sector sit together and be more specific on what kind of skills that we need? Because we tend to speak very broadly about lack of skills, but if IFAP tells us that we must really become more focused on this issue.
Thank you. Honourable
thanks. Following on preceding speakers, let me also express gratitude and a very informative input. If you could please just go back to the graph that shows those countries, even if you do it when you respond, let me not confuse things. The one that shows South Africa manufacturing value added versus emerging Asia. I just need the real message as well as the following graph. Then my second point is, do universities and technicons create a platform where they meet and compare ideas? I'm stretching the point made by Comrade Babaza that shouldn't they meet? If they do meet really, and with private sector, government, why is it that we are not at the optimum level where other countries are? Then the last one is, it looks like our strategies are not necessarily taking on board those that are at the periphery. What should be done to take those on the periphery and bring them onto the mainstream of the economy?
Thank you. Honourable Van der Vest, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. Professor Travella, I see a great potential in your suggestion of a joint government business research initiative. Now, my question is that now new? Do you see that research to be done by universities? With the assistance of the Research Foundation, CSIR, if you could just share a few ideas as to where you think that research should be situated and why it should be done. Thank you.
Thank you for that very interesting question and to the point, Honourable Marie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor, that graph where you compare Latin America, the world, Asia, Southeast Asia, those are the, I think, some of the so-called South countries where people want to benchmark us against. One gets the impression from that somehow or somewhere we don't have those competitive edges anymore, and that IFAP is actually trying to be too much for everyone, rather than to concentrate on niche markets and see where we can be competitive, where we can create a competitive edge for South Africa in the world. Is that the case? What do you see? Why do we compare so badly against those countries, not even mentioning the others that you haven't shown? The other thing is just on exchange rate. Obviously, everybody wants a weak exchange rate for export purposes. But currently, maybe you can give us more information in terms of our current standing, imports versus exports. What do we need to produce in South Africa? Where do we get that machinery, that equipment, that technology from? And is the answer really a weak exchange rate? Is the one not going to take away from the other one? If you can just maybe elaborate more on that in terms of also a competitive position in the world market.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Indy Kalana.
Thank you, Chair. I will also echo my commendation of the President's report, although I got it halfway, but it's quite illustrative. My question is, with regard to unprocessed, the reference to the processing made to discouraging exports in relatively unprocessed form or encouraging in more processed form, I suppose that's linked to beneficiation strategies and programs. Professor Trekker, tell us, to what extent are you satisfied, or what's your views about IPA's focus on beneficiation strategies as a strategy? Number two, Chair, you make mention of infrastructure as a constraint. That triggers another question to me, logistics. What's your take on it? Can you just comment around logistics, the extent to which it needs to be focused on, the extent to which IPEP also addresses the need to or how to handle the revitalization of logistics? Thank you.
Right, it's over to Professor Kagena to come in here. Look, our members have taken 15-20 minutes there, and you yourself have 25, close on 30. I think I've run into problems, unless you can answer these, respond effectively. There may be one or two that you would tell us you will single out for a written response, because you're only going to be given 5 minutes to respond. So just work out which ones you may need to respond to in writing.
Let me try and fire away. Firstly, leave out the skills questions, not because I think they're not important, I think they're fundamental, but I'm not a skills expert as in the broad sense. So I wouldn't comment on the very details of those. The first question, what are the negative or disadvantages about IPEP? I mean, one of the things is that it does cost money. And the money which is being spent on IPEP could be spent on other things like education and health and so on. So you need to be sure that this is a good spending of money, a good investment of resources in the long term. I think it's necessary, I think we can't do without it, but obviously this is a downside. Another negative, which I could mention, is that for sectors which are not targeted, not just that they're losing something, but they're losing something in relative sense. And this is an intrinsic industrial policy. And this is, if you target some sectors, you're implicitly not targeting other ones. So we need to be sure that the sectors which are not targeted are sectors which either can cope by themselves, or which, if they stagnate a bit, we can live with that. Obviously, you can't target everything, but you need to be aware of those kinds of costs. On SMEs and what's in it for them in the industrial policy, I think there's two aspects which are particularly important. One is on competition policy, which may open up more space for SMEs, and the second is on finance. And we know that SMEs have difficulty in accessing finance and set at reasonable costs. And I think that the interventions of IPEP around the DFI can be helpful in that regard. And as I said, I think that it perhaps needs to also address the private financial sector more on the SMEs. And the last point of the first honourable member was around the high tech versus labour intensive. I think it's a really crucial issue, and it's a really difficult issue. As I said, it's not a linear trade-off, it's not necessarily either or, but to some extent there is a trade-off. The problem is that we don't have a choice except to address unemployment. I mean, it's an economic, social, moral imperative. It does tie our hands to some extent, having to prioritize that. It does tie our hands as to what else we can do and what else we can target. If we didn't have high unemployment, these are probably not the sectors that we would target. We probably wouldn't target clothing and textiles as one of our priority sectors if we were sitting with 5% unemployment. So I think what can be done, one thing would be to look at activities which are not bad on either. I mean, obviously, don't want to just target sort of things which are mediocre all around, but activities which are relatively labor intensive and also which are relatively demand dynamic or have technological potential are good candidates for targeting. Also, to look at the incentivization of more labor intensive production methods, even within relatively high tech sectors. So, not easy, but I think something which can be done. And again, something which is unlikely to happen by itself unless there's specific measures in place to incentivize that. The next honourable member asked, can I name any country that's industrialized without state intervention? No, I can't. I don't think there is any, even the US, is a lot of industrial policy measures. The fourth state role that I mentioned and which you asked about, yes, I think we are in all forms of state roles, but less so as a producer, and that IPAC itself is more silent on state as producer and industrial policy. And I think, as I mentioned, it's something which I think there is a scope for a bigger state role in. You mentioned around the IFCO and so on and so on, and some of the negative experiences of those for industrial policy. I think there's definitely a bigger state role as well in new activities that may be emerging. Strategic protection vis-a-vis the WTO. Yes, the WTO is a constraint, but I don't think that we are yet up against the wall in terms of what we can do in terms of WTO, because other countries are also constrained by WTO, but they do more than us. So of course we don't want to violate WTO, but we need to look at what is the maximum which we can do within the regulations and constraints of the WTO. The next question was around concentration. I think the difficulty which we have in South Africa with respect to concentration is that we've got a high degree of concentration in particular sectors specifically. And in some ways we're getting a lot of the negative effects of that concentration without some of the positive spin-off. In the sense that large concentrated industries can be very beneficial for industrial development, as we've seen in East Asia, for example. But that's on condition that the rents which those large concentrated industries get are closely regulated, and you ensure that the benefits of and the rents from those large concentrated industries are socially used. For example, that you force them to invest, you force them to technologically upgrade and so on. The worst case scenario is where you have these large concentrated industries doing their own thing, getting the benefits, but not found as that. So you need obviously a nuanced competition policy, and ICAP is quite strong on that, which on the one hand looks at a different concentration, but you don't want to just break everything up. You do need, in some sectors, those in order to compete internationally, but you need to look at what happens with their rent. Honourable Member Mabasa asked about the tasks and the sort of take-home methods. I think the basic message there is that we're falling behind other countries in terms of our manufacturing value added. It's not a new thing. I mean, the start went back to 1970, and we can say at least since about 80 or so we've been falling behind, and that we haven't caught up in the last 10 years. We've improved slightly, but we haven't caught up. So the basic message is that we can't carry on as things are because we are likely to fall further and further behind unless we do things differently, both government, private sector, all around. The issue of the research initiative and who should sort of house that. I don't know, specific thoughts, perhaps CSIR universities and so on could be called that. But basically, you also need people who could run with that, right? You don't need research which is just going to sort of go out there. You need, what I'm thinking about is not just the generic research, but we actually look at specific products, how much of it is produced, what is their cost structure, and so on. And this is what China does. They look at an industry. There's an industry for wine, let's say. We're not producing wine, we'd like to produce wine. How is it done? Let's go all around the world, see where it's produced, what is the climate, how much does it cost, how much does the bottling cost. well. And then I looked at NSP, how can we do, can we do this feasibly? At the moment, they've started doing it, and one's pretty horrible at the moment, but I won't be surprised if in 10, 20 years' time we might be drinking it. On the exchange rate and import versus export, yes, obviously the weaker exchange rates are the more your imports cost and your capital equipment cost and so on. So that is obviously a trade-off. I guess in the long term, obviously you want to move towards producing some of that capital equipment more domestically, right? Not everything you can produce, but you also want to incentivize, you want to make it more financially viable to produce some of that domestically than to import it. But I think in dealing with that trade-off of the cost of imports and exports, we really need to prioritize boosting our exports, because we can't just look at keeping our costs low and not doing anything with that. Did I stop there?
You see, our problem is there's still a change over from Lord to the next one, and we want to ensure that at least that's done by 10:30. So, what we would like to say is thank you very, very much. I think that we would welcome your paper in support of the PowerPoint, as well as the questions you did not have time to respond to, and of course anything else you would like to add in that regard. I think members of the portfolio committee have felt this highly valuable, otherwise they would have been the first to put up their hands to say, Chair, can we direct you on the process here? But there was not a squeak out of them, they kept quiet. So we're going to shift over now, thank you very, very much. Members, just to remind you, we only started at 5:25 and not 9:00 as such. So we do need to try and all remember the time constraints that we have. We're moving rapidly over to the ArcelorMittal. And the ArcelorMittal, is that correct, that we have here will be... We never ever have presentations here. What we do have are briefings occasionally, and we have engagements. And we have the CEO, Nonkululeko Nyembezi-Lete, picked up, just he's an A there, who will be making that briefing to us, sharing it with us. I said before, there will not be a tea break, so as and when you want to replenish your tea or coffee, please do so. There will not be a tea break. So, I think we're more or less all in one place here. And I want to say to members, we're going to have to insist on just two questions. We would like to get round to the different members, because everyone sees things differently. Are we ready from the ArcelorMittal to see, I see all the technology is working. So that's
the helping one here, and I am ready to go.
Right.
I see your members.
Now, just on that there, just after 10:30, as you yourself are aware. And once again, my request would be to keep this within 15-20. As you can see, people always seem to take an extra minute or two after that.
Well, let's see what we can do with that, Madam Chair. I'll just try to touch on a few areas, and I thought it would be more useful, given that ArcelorMittal has invested this house, to allow perhaps more time, in our case, for a Q&A. So any time to cover these 4 or 5 areas that I have on hand. I'm taking a very still industry-focused approach to looking at IPEP, as one would expect, and thought, or we went through and said, what actually would benefit the primary steel industry in the first instance and the broader steel industry in the second instance, in a sense what Lena was talking about, what IPEP does and any industrial policy does to pick winners and losers. And we want to make sure that our sector is not a loser in this, because we believe that it's a very, very strategic sector. Certainly the choice of the automotive component sector as one of those is very positive for the steel industry, and it's not just primary, but it does touch right through. but it is not enough. We would have liked to see more, and I'll get back to that a little bit later on. We also noted that in IPEC 2, DPI has now opted for a more grant-based scheme as opposed to tax-based incentives as in the past, and wonders about the administrative capacity of the department to administer this. In a sense, it's what the previous speaker spoke about, institutional capacity to administer some of these programs. So as you get a little bit further on the horizontal scale of their chart, more will be demanded to make it work. So I just wanted to put that on the table for the committee to debate maybe some other time. I did want to use this time to tell you about what we have done as an industry to try and generate employment and revive a sector that was stagnating in both the primary steel as well as for the downscaling manufacturing. Our industry has had for almost two decades now an export incentive scheme whereby the mills or the primary producers aim to make the sector more competitive by paying them incentives to equalize prices of the input material in terms of steel, so that the price that they get as a domestic producer in South Africa actually equals what we would get in the export market. So we give them what we term the export parity price. The export parity price for any tradable goods or any goods that one exports out of the country is always going to be lower than a domestic price, because from that you deduct logistics costs for one thing, you deduct port charges for another thing, so that your product is competitive when it lands in a foreign market. We set up a rebate system, which in the first instance was being administered by the mills themselves, so ArcelorMittal administered the rebate scheme to pay this differential in prices between domestic and export parity prices. And the reason for that can be seen on this chart. In the 70s and 60s, when the South African government at that time went through a massive infrastructure development program, the steel industry invested to be able to tackle and address the opportunities that were being thrown up in that. That is shown on your chart by that gray chart that simply goes off the scale if you look on the extreme left-hand side. But of course, the power stations eventually got built and the roads got finished, and then the industry sat with all of this excess capacity. And you can see the gray line, what it's doing in the interim between that infrastructure boom and the one that we're just now currently in. There was complete stagnation, not only in primary steel, but in the downstream sector as well. You can see that in the very initial stages, the South African industry was consuming over 5 million tons of steel per annum. In the stagnation phase, it was a good year when you managed to get to 4 million tons. So the industry had nowhere to go except to go to export markets. When your domestic demand collapses, what you do is you go to the export sector, and this is why we set up this export incentive scheme. And so what would happen is we would demand that the downstream manufacturers demonstrate value add. If they buy steel from ArcelorMittal at a certain price, they would have to demonstrate a minimum of 20% value add before they would qualify for this export parity price that I've referred to. And you can see that it was reasonably successful, because towards the latter part, towards the right of that chart, you can see the industry utilization begin to inch up to some degree, and the consumption of steel then starting to increase. Clearly, we're now on the up and up again, because domestic demand has been underpinned by government's current infrastructure development program, although it actually isn't as good as what we had in the 60s and 70s. So we are still looking for a little bit more stimulation of the steel sector to reach the heights that we know it is capable of reaching. If we just take a step back and think through what the advantages have been of the scheme that I've just talked about, it did succeed in stimulating demand. The industry did get busy. It earned foreign exchange for the country. At some point, we were quite an important foreign exchange earner for the fiscus. But in my mind, it also drove the notion of value addition and exposed our manufacturers to global competition. And those things are actually quite important in making us continually upgrade our own facilities, upgrade our own skills,
to continue to be globally competitive. In essence, by having a bigger base over which to spread your costs, it lowers the unit cost in terms of fixed costs, and that also just stimulates the competitiveness. So it becomes quite a virtuous circle the more you can tap into export markets. And all of this is just to drive home that what needs to be very visible and very tangible in any industrial policy that we pursue as a country is an export focus. If that isn't there, in essence, I don't believe that domestic demand alone can make industrial policy successful. I do have to also point out that there were disadvantages, and I'm going to get that to that in a second, but I just wanted to show you what, in rand and cents, one company can do, and therefore you have to think whether at government level the kinds of monies that are being talked about in terms of IPEC 2 are sufficient. If you look at just the value-added assistance, which is the first row in my table, and you add over 5 years what Aslan Mittag has spent stimulating exports, it's over 1.4 billion rand. So I think you need to then think, if government is planning on its new IPEC 2 to be putting 3.6 billion rand over 3 years, is that enough? I'm talking about one company, one industry sector. Here we're talking about 12 sectors across the economy in South Africa. And I do think that when it comes to industrial policy, you can't shortchange yourself because the stakes are so high. So I would also wish the committee at some point to debate whether there is a sufficient commitment of resource to stimulate industry in South Africa in the current plan. Now, the other two rows in our table are actually interesting, and I'm going to just touch on them for a minute. We also, on the odd occasion, depending on our own commercial assessment, will put in place schemes to, for example, protect certain downstream industries from import substitution. It would work more or less the same way. We would put a program together for a specific finished goods type manufacturer to be able to compete with imports. Now, this links in very much to Professor Tregoner's comments about the fact that in this space that we are in, when you erode your industrial base, you don't get it back. You hardly ever get it back. So if we can see that there is a finished goods manufacturer that is busy dying, we have to make a choice whether to let it die forever or to put in a program to try and save that. Now, in the 2008, quarter four, 2009 recession, this country had an opportunity to do this. To actually take a hard look to say, in this downturn, which are the downstream industry sectors that are busy collapsing, and to do something about it, but we didn't. And it's curious to me why that didn't happen, but we just allowed industries to die, we shouted about erosion, but actually the country didn't actually take any action to do that. If I contrast that, for example, with our colleagues in Brazil, Aslan Mittag has a plant in Brazil. The Brazilian government got all the steel producers together in a room within a few weeks of the financial and economic crisis, said, check what we want in order to continue servicing the car industry, the business industry, and they said, we need import tariff protection. We cannot produce steel at $400 a ton. Within a couple of weeks, Brazil had a 30% import tariff on steel. I am just telling you what other countries are the length of other countries are prepared to go to preserve their industrial base. And it worries me that in South Africa, very often, we are not prepared to do what is necessary to do so because, I don't know, we're afraid of WTO and so that is another message, is that the country at point of crisis needs to move with greater speed to shore up the country's manufacturing base, because it is the one way that we're going to be able to lead ourselves out of recession. Some of the value-added export sectors that we supported in the export scheme are listed on this chart. I will not go through them in detail. We have gone back and looked at some of them just to see how they're doing. It's very clear that it has become a mainstay of some of them, and they would not actually be able to continue with any degree of certainty in the export activities without this kind of support. So for the time being, the steel industry is going to continue to do this with or without government. But what we do want the downstream industry to do is to also have a look. Sorry, I'm looking for a charger right now.
What we do want the export, the downstream manufacturing centers to also look at is what they are doing within their own structure to make sure that they remain competitive. But just for this particular chart, what I wanted to comment on is government is very clear, I think, and it comes through in IPEF, that government focus on building and improving infrastructure is important generally. For this sector, it's doubly important because we have to move goods to ports, we have to move goods to overseas markets. So for us, the deficiencies in infrastructure are very, very serious. We would think that this should be the priority number one in any kind of industrial policy, is to make sure that the logistics infrastructure can support the industry. People that are importing or buying from us in Kenya aren't going to wait just because Transnet cannot load at the port. The public sector infrastructure investment program I'm going to talk about, that's very well documented in the plan. I think Fiona covered it quite well. The localization program, we've lost some opportunity. There is still some in the future, but when you read through some government documents, and IPEF is not the only one by any means that does this, it always seems to take the present looking forward. There isn't, I think, a sufficient degree of scrutiny on why certain programs have failed in the past. This localization and leveraging the public sector infrastructure investment program has been known for 10 years. Alex Owen spoke about it when he was minister. I don't see in the document sufficient understanding and insight as to why it is that having gone through the infrastructure program up to this point, this has so far not yielded the results that we were looking for, and I think the document could benefit from spending some time with the industry to understand from our perspective why we think things are not going the way that they ought to go. Okay, so what do we have to do on our side and further downstream? I do believe that the country has fallen behind in terms of its own competitive cost structures. We're not quite as cost competitive as we were a few years ago. We certainly haven't kept up with our investment spend in our facilities and our plants to the degree that you see plants in the Far East also have done, so we've got old facilities. The problem in South Africa only has been that because we're a medium-sized country, we don't normally get the economies of scale that one can get in a Chinese manufacturing setup, for example. And that is why a lot of the countries that are dominating the export sector either are large in their domestic bases, or they've been able to stimulate their export sector to be very large indeed in order to get those economies of scale. In South Africa, we continue to fall behind in this area, in something that we need to try and fix in one way or the other. I've already spoken about other barriers such as ports and rails. I'm not going to repeat that, but it continually comes back as a very significant barrier in our lives. Given that we're talking about industrial policy, I just need to finish off this chart by pointing out that very often the steel sector in particular comes up against unfair competition, but certainly uneven playing fields, because in a lot of countries that have steelmaking capabilities, that is always considered a strategic sector. It is always selected in the industrial policies of these countries. It is always given certain protections and incentives and stimulatory instruments to keep it going because it's such a large absorber of unskilled and semi-skilled labor. So when we don't get that in this country, we are totally on our own. I think one of the honorable members talked about ISCO. Because ISCO came from the government sector, was built with taxpayer money, essentially the government said, right, you now can be globally competitive on your own, but we do not get any kind of facilitation to be globally competitive. So that just needs to be borne in mind, that we compete with other countries, which in fact in their home countries, like China, get a lot of China support. A lot of what is in the chart following has been covered by Fiona. I don't think that we need to talk again about the exchange rate. It seems to be well understood that it's a particular friction and pressure point in our line. She talked about the dramatic decline in South Africa's manufacturing exports. We observed the same high interest rates regime she spoke about. So, you know, at least we do agree with the academic profession, even though we're looking at it from very, very different vantage points. To conclude then, what do we like particularly about IPEP? We like the fact that it's a more focused, more action-oriented program. I think that the DCI team can be congratulated in trying to now slim down the policy, even in terms of the number of pages that people have to go through, to be more focused. We think that it will boost confidence as people begin to think about investment in productive capacity for the future, to know that there will be support will be an enormously confidence-boosting factor. We like the fact that the vehicle and component manufacturing industries continue to be one of the targeted sectors that is broadly positive for the sector. We also think that other industry sectors that IPEP is beginning to think about, like the electric vehicles, green industries, that would also be quite positive for steel, not just in the primary sector like ourselves, but all the way further downstream, all the way to finished, to the finished sector. We think that macro and microeconomic policies, again, I think Fiona covered this in some detail, but the coordination between the two in order to drive in the same direction came through quite clearly in the documentation, and that is to be encouraged, and that we think it will enhance human development and have a positive impact on the balance payment. Essentially, where we're driving to is we would like to see the export focus in the steel sector continue and be encouraged, and whatever instruments that we can dream about to achieve that end actually need to be quite a key priority of any kind of industrial policy in South Africa. I'm very pleased about the broad understanding that in some sectors it's quite important to have large industrial champions, and except in those sectors that they could have monopolistic market power, but then your regulation must step in to make sure that that's not abused. I know that in a personal legislative corridor, monopolistic power is a bad thing in its own. Where I work, it isn't. It is bad only to the degree that it is abused. When we go around the world and see some of the size of corporates that we have to compete against, they're many times our size. So size is not our enemy here. It's abuse of size that is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Nyembezi Hinta, for that very succinct briefing that highlighted the critical points and also some suggestions. Thank you very much. It's over to the members now. Well, we've been set an example here, 20 minutes of briefing. Please can we restrict our questions, comments, etc. to 2 minutes maximum, please, or rather 2 questions. We're starting Honourable Maria, Honourable Mabasa, Honourable Van der Westhuizen, Honourable Ambrosini.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for the submission. Your company is actually one of those that we need an hour or 2 hours to interrogate. Because what we have heard over the last couple of days and last week is that it seems like you're the culprit in many people's eyes. Just on the automotive industry, I want to ask a question. Because what we have heard is that your steel gets exported and they must import for manufacturing and assembling cars. What is your percentage of a vehicle that gets manufactured? Do you know the percentage of which is your product, which is steel related, coming from your company? Because we have heard that 70% is not local content. So how can you contribute to that? You've mentioned that committee will probably have to go and apply our minds in terms of the money available for what you want to do. Is it your opinion that we want to do too much for too many with the limited amount of money available? If that is the case, you know, what do you propose? Because you have made that observation or criticism, but eventually you've said that, you know, wonderful, IPEP is doing the right thing, it's identifying the right sectors. It sounds contradictory. because obviously the limitation that we've got is money. So, so what do we need to do then?
Thank you.
Thank you, Colleague Chair. When Ms. Nyembezi Heita, when I greeted her and she said, with Heita added, I thought she meant when I greet her, I must say Heita. So, but when we speak of a limited world into which we can export, is it not that if we look at Southern Africa and Africa, we should see that as an opportunity, so that we can even see it as part of South Africa for the convenience of a large market for us? And then my second question is, cooperatives and small businesses, to what degree is ArcelorMittal playing a role in the creation of such? Because if you don't play a role in creating those, it will mean that those that are at the outside the circle of the vibrant economy will remain there. Then the last one is on skills. To what degree do you work with technical universities and even the Department of Labor towards the creation of appropriate skills, not only for yourself, but for the country? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Yes, it is true, you weren't here a week or two ago and everybody was blaming ArcelorMittal as a primary or a producer of primary products for the high prices of our secondary goods. And may I just warn you that I see some two presentations down the line we'll be speaking or hearing from the Institute for Steel Construction. Now, I would like you to, you've avoided this subject. Where you stand accused of not only producing goods at you know, prices and assisting with rebates, etc., but where you stand to be accused of pushing up prices, where we've heard from people in the canning industry, etc., that they need to buy their materials, their raw materials, at prices where it's at import parity and where they would have been able almost to import materials. Well, would you just please tell us, because also in these days we hear of agreements between Kumba and ArcelorMittal, which to a layperson like myself just sounds as if ArcelorMittal has had a very good deal, and yet our local manufacturing industry is saying if ArcelorMittal would just, you know, drop the prices and become more cost effective, South Africa would be in a position to compete so much better. So please address that issue for us.
Thank you very much, Honourable Ambrosini.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'm going to waive my opportunity of asking questions, and we hope that I can ask an extra one later for a further presentation. I just want to make two very quick comments to my colleagues. The first one, I think this is one of the most important presentations we have received, and I hope that if we ever get to the deliberation stage, we receive the attention it should. I think it was excellent. The second one is that I think the press colleagues will understand, especially the DA colleagues, why we made ourselves so unpopular in pointing out how the Reserve Bank is completely out of tune with the policies of the country. We have one presentation after the other pointing out of the problem with the exchange rate, and this has been pointed out for 6 months, but they are giving more attention to banking interests than to manufacturing interests. Thank you.
Me on the hop there, thank you very much. Just a couple from myself. You alluded to Brazil
using it as an example about a country that could take action quickly to address costs or exports to bring down, to certainly ensure that the local industry remains competitive. And you referred to, I hope I'm right, 30% tariff I just wanted to find out, I am not, just the top of my head, recall whether Brazil is classified as a developed or developing country, because I'm certainly aware of the status of South Africa. And as you know, the degree of tariff that you can have does depend also on that particular classification and what your ceiling, or if you like, your space is between the two. So it would be helpful to me to get a full appreciation if you would just, I'm sure you do have that information. The other thing was, perhaps in relation to that comment, the earlier or later reference when you indicated that steel industry then, if you like, is playing on a very unlevel playing field, if you like. Perhaps you would just clarify that. I mean, we do certainly hear that, and you were talking, it would appear in general. The other thing is your reference in part to, you know, if you were going to be in full production, etc., the domestic market would not be big enough for you. From what we heard earlier, and what we may have read, even many of us, we have learned that South Africa itself is not supplying its domestic market for one reason or another, that there is the domestic goods that are coming in from outside, because perhaps the type of steel that is being produced in the country for one kind of capital piece of equipment or good or whatever is not necessarily the particular the quality level, if you like, or the specification level that may be required, for example, in pots and pans, and then of course in steel girders and the like. So if you could just clarify the issue of the domestic market and the steel production. Of course, one takes account of the point you made that insufficient scrutiny has been paid to why certain programs have failed in the past. And it may be pertinent for you to enlighten us as to why you may have found yourself looking at that same principle of insufficient scrutiny, while possibly the current dilemma that faces the steel industry now faces ArcelorMittal and the country at large. We have got the time now for you to respond, and we've all made good time, you yourselves have. So if you would respond to us, to all the questions now, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will ask you to repeat the last question when I get to that, because I didn't fully understand it. But I thought I should just start off with the pricing, because it's a big issue, and probably we need more time than that. Let me explain the philosophical underpinnings, if you like, of our approach to pricing. For any public or private company, when you approach pricing, you really have two fundamental criteria that you think about. The first one is to have a price that is attractive to your customers. And the second one is to maximize the profitability. Those are the only two. Those are your two constraints, right? So you move from that and you say, well, how do you determine a price that's going to be attractive to your customers? Typically, in a competitive market, you have to look at your competitors. What are your competitors pricing at? If you go above that, you're not going to sell products, so typically you will go to within that. You then look at flat products in South Africa and say there's only two manufacturers, which are ourselves and Hytel, and that's insufficient competition because we don't necessarily always intersect in terms of the steel grades that we produce. So what is then going to be your approach? It's the next best alternative. Your next best alternative is the import, because it's a global marketplace, and therefore in a globalized world, it's pretty easy to land in Durban in a reasonably short period of time. That's how IPP works. It says, what is the next best alternative for a globally tradable product? And IPP tends to be the best, and it's used across the world. It's not something that is visited on South Africa because of cruel manufacturers and gouging steel producers. We then got to this debate about access to cheap iron ore and how was ArcelorMittal going to square up because it had access to cheap iron ore. And after several interactions with the DTI on precisely the kinds of things that you have pointed out, we hit on a pricing approach that still really respected my need to make a profit, but also started to address some of the requirements to make steel cheaper in South Africa for the downstream sector to assist the downstream sector to be more competitive in its own space. So then, from moving from IPP, the question became, okay, so what do you do then? What we did was go and say, we are going to look at the domestic price of steel in markets with which we compete in the export market. We chose China, we chose China because it's the ferocious exporter. We chose Germany because Germany is the biggest exporter in the world. We chose the US because it was then a big trading partner of South Africa. And we chose Russia as a proxy for a developing market, which had roughly similar characteristics with South Africa in the sense that it has access to its own input commodities. And we said, what is a domestic market in that country, took an average of that, overlaid with the exchange rate, and used that here. What that says in simple terms is that if you've got a wheelbarrow manufacturer sitting in Durban and another one sitting in any one of these four on average, the price they get for steel at the input level is the same. We are equalizing that input cost. Their ability from that point on to convert the steel or fabricate it to a finished product then becomes their own competitive thing. But the South African manufacturer cannot compete even with us. The question then becomes why. I promise you that even if we drop the price of steel, the Chinese will still land a wheelbarrow in South Africa cheaper than the Durban producer can. Steel is one of the factors, but it certainly is not the be-all and end-all that you hear them screaming out. I mean, somebody's going to be the bad boy and get whipped, fine, we take that, but I think when we look at facts and figures, we need to be a little bit more serious about understanding the underlying factors. And I'm afraid what I get told on a daily basis simply does not accord with the facts. So I'm sorry to say that if we fix the steel price alone, none of the stuff we're talking about here today would happen necessarily. So I think that you can be very candid about that. So we use a domestic basket. The domestic basket, in a rising market such as the one we had in 2008, resulted in domestic prices in South Africa being on average 15% below IPP. And yet we did not see any particular success out of the downstream industry as a result of that in that year. Admittedly, in 2009, because it was a poor year for the steel industry broadly and all other industry sectors, I suppose, our prices were not at those sorts of levels. It was a declining market. So you have to also go and examine in those years when the downstream industry did get a leg up in terms of getting slightly better prices for steel, how did they perform? And I'm sorry to say they didn't perform any better than they did in previous years. So I'm going to leave that one at that. I went to visit Soccer City last week, and it is a magnificent piece of work. I've been told my Mons Mapida is better, I haven't been there, and so I walked around with some of the steel fabricators and asked, where did that steel come from? Where did that come from? And the bulk of the steel that went to the failure is South African produced, because a lot of it was simple. We produce simple grades of steel, and we are going to continue to produce simple grades of steel. We're not going to go up to the kind of more specialized grades in which Europe and America have specialized. We cannot compete with the level of automation and technology that they've been able to deploy, which is why in the auto sector, we don't bring in that 70% that somebody spoke about that they say they have to import. They will continue having to import that because Catalan Tap isn't going to do it. And for us, I'm sorry to tell you, the auto industry is 10% of our sales. It's not big. We only give them really, really simple products. Because we are a global group, it's very easy for us to bring in the steel grades that are required that we don't produce, and that's how it's going to be. But on day-to-day rebar, reinforcing bars that the construction sector needs, for example, those we produce, and actually our quality is some of the best in the world. So we are going to be very focused on products that we think have got a long-term market in South Africa and on the African continent. Now, somebody talked about what we're doing to push forward this concept of the regional and continental market, and I'm glad somebody asked that question because, in my view, that's the future. It's the future not only for our industry, but it's the future for this economy. Because if all we're going to do is look at the 44 million people that live in this country and then we're going to produce goods and services for that, we're going to be somehow the base for the African continent, but there is no service that targets continental Africa from South Africa if we ever try. So we are now positioning our business to look at sub-Saharan Africa as a space in which we play. We've selected one niche market where we've traditionally done well in East Africa, particularly Kenya, and starting to be as reliable a supplier for the Kenyan steel industry as we are in South Africa. We want to be as dependable in that market. They know that we'll always be there for them. We're not being opportunistic, because I think what the steel industry in South Africa has done, and maybe other industry sectors have done, is they've tried to sell as much as they can in the domestic market, and whatever surplus, they try to find a market somewhere on the African continent. Well, we're not going to do that now. We are saying, what does the Kenyan downstream manufacturer need? And every month, we're going to make sure a ship arrives and can service that. And once we're successful in establishing that base, we'll do it in West Africa, and we'll do it in other African markets that are growing. So for us, Lumika, this is the way of the future. It is our current strategy. That's how we're moving forward. Skills, IFCO once upon a time, I mean, it was dowdy and it didn't make very much money for government, but what it did do is it produced A-class artisans and engineers in South Africa. There was a time when South Africa sort of moved away from vocational training and apprenticeships, and I don't know quite what happened, but we've now come back and said, in fact, I think when we had then Deputy President Kumzile Nabunuga do the Afisa initiative, Aflamikal was one of the six corporates in South Africa that stepped forward and said, we will take up the challenge, we will produce for the country in a 5-year period 60,000 artisans over and above our own needs as a six. Even in the downturn, and I don't say with pride that last year we lost 440 million rand, but even in that downturn, we continued with that skills development program. We did not decommit from it. It also has to be said that we've had great support from the Department of Labor in terms of skills grants. Our MIASITA actually is the best in the whole land. We work very cooperatively with them. So it's a very big part of Aflamikal's life. We've invested a lot in skills development, as I said, both for our own use as well as for the country. But of course, we can't really talk about skills in South Africa without talking about black skills in particular and women skills as a particular subset of that. If you look at the bursary students that Aflamikal takes in for engineering students now, it's more than 50% black and rising. We have established math and science centers in Sibukeng, which is very close to our Funderbijl facility. We've just opened one here in Frederiksberg, close to our Saldanha plant, and we locate those close to black schools because if we can catch good potential math students at grade 10 and 11, we push them through the pipeline all the way through bursary, all the way to come into service with us in the South. So we've been able to take three children from a really bottom class school in Sibukeng and put them in an engineering college for the first time last year. So there's hope in those kinds of interventions. I think it took us some time to start intervening in this area. We were just taking people going into tertiary. This year, we've sent 20 children from the Sibukeng Math and Science Center to the Vaal Technicon, for example. But once they come into Aflamikal itself, we at the moment have got more intake in terms of black production learner trainees, in terms of black artisans, than at any other time in the history of the company. I think, Madam Chair, I've probably run out of time, but I'm happy to submit a paper where we propose, for example, the issue about limitation of funds versus the sector that has been chosen. It's a continuous effort. We do have to balance the fact that resources are always limited, but the needs are unlimited, and how to draw the line. But just off the top of my head, I'm going to have to say the money that's been voted is not enough. We need a little bit more money to kickstart ourselves back to the top of the grey line, and then you need a bit less money to keep yourself there. But we're coming from a long way back. We cannot. When you spend this money, sometimes you might as well not bother. They're not going to make much of an impact. So if it is 12 too many, it's too many for 3 billion. And I will send you the information on Brazil. Brazil is a developing country. India did not impose tariffs, and again, in India, the steel sector is viewed as strategic. They did not impose tariffs. What they did do, though, is to impose an export tax on iron ore to make iron ore cheaper for domestic primary steel producers. China uses a myriad of instruments to assist the industry. It's a huge number. And you've got with
so thank you very much. What would also be helpful, you've made several references to the learnerships and something similar, as it were, that you're involved in. You mentioned now a figure of 50,000 commitments. It would be helpful to know when that began and where you are currently with that, you know, and so we get a very clear understanding in this regard. There are a couple of questions that remain unanswered, as you know, and we hope that you'll take the opportunity in writing to respond to that. But as members have indicated, we also regard the steel industry, generally speaking, as a strategic industry. Indeed, the government does. We regard it as such in respect of the infrastructural developments and so on. But thank you very much. Mr. Mbezi, Hater, and your team for being with us here today and sharing with us some of your decisions and the response to the EPUB and so on, and your suggestions. Thank you very much. At this point, members, I have already said on several occasions the IS team, and that they're not a specific tea break as such, but that we are asking members to just use a rolling tea break. And we're going to have a changeover of the National Association of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers representing the generic and local pharmaceutical companies, from what I can understand. And during that short changeover, I just have to speak to someone for 1 or 2 minutes just at the door, Professor Tregenna, and I shall just ask the whip to come across here, because we don't want to stop at all, just over the next couple of minutes, so that there's no break in the proceeding, please. So we're moving right across to the next one here. We have with us Dr. Skumbuza Godwana, chairperson of the National Association of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers, the deputy CEO, Cipla Medpro Private Limited, generic medicine company. So it's just a short for myself. I'm just removing myself from the chair for a very short while. I think you've already seen how the process is proceeding. 15 minutes, and then our engagement with you.
Good morning. Are we allowed to proceed?
I think you can file or not.
I can file. Well, thank you very much. As the chair has said, my name is Kumbuzo Ngozwana. I'm the chairman of the National Association of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers of South Africa. I'm here with Paul Enby. Paul is one of the NAPM EXCO members, as well as the CEO of Pharmadynamics. We have Ms. Rafila Indelam, who's the executive director of the NAPM, and we've got a colleague, Mr. Musa Ref, from one of the pharmaceutical companies. Let me begin by thanking the committee and the chair for affording us the opportunity to come and present today on this very important matter. I think I'd like to preface my input, my presentation, with 3 points. The first one is that in a globalized world, a small country like South Africa, with a population of 45 or 48 million, cannot hope to get economies of scale from protection and the domestic market only. It by default necessity has to look for export. The second point is that competitiveness accrues from manufacturing competencies. This would include, obviously, production costs, plant construction costs, API production, full integration as it were. Not necessarily incentives and protection.
Is that not in the power?
I'm just prepping. I want to come to the presentation now. And I think the last point that I just want to premise my discussion on is that as South Africa moves into the advent of the national health insurance, with our unique disease burden, HIV/AIDS, and increasing lifestyle disease burden, of course, the question is, can we afford to do so with medicines that will cost more just because they are produced locally? Shouldn't the debate really be around access? With that said, I just want to move into the presentation. By way of outline, I'll talk a little bit about the NAPM, the local or generic industries, our member specifically. I'll gloss over the issues around industrial policy. You know that more than I do. I'll then go and address some key concerns around the ICAP process. Now, if I just talk about who we are, the NAPM is the longest trade association in the country. It was formed in 1977. It's one of 5 associations. But importantly, it represents a very diverse group. We've got small, medium-sized, and large companies, listed and private, and we have the most empowered grouping of all the trade associations. Now, very briefly, our vision, obviously we'll leave this behind, so I'll not dwell too much on this. We aim to champion affordable healthcare by supporting and developing the South African pharmaceutical industry as a national asset. And I think everything that I speak to will obviously draw from this vision. Now, in terms of our members, what I've done there is just to highlight some members. We have some SMMEs highlighted in green. We've got some empowered companies, Dr. Reddy's, Vika Healthcare. They're all listed there. And of course, we have some multinational pharmaceutical companies. If you look at some of our members, you'll see there we've got Teva, which is the largest generic company in the world. We've got Sandoz, which is the second biggest in the world, and Mylan, which is the third biggest. And of course, a number of these companies are competing globally, the Rembesis, the Dr. Reddy's, and so on. Now, what the NAPM, as I said, represent the interests of generic companies locally, but of course, we contribute to the global and the local discourse on healthcare issues, and of course, pharma industry issues in particular, and I've just got a list of some of the things that we are active in. Now, in terms of the importance of our members, and the local industry, obviously by enhancing competition, we promote greater patient access because affordability is a factor when you want to increase competition. We create self-reliance in a critical sector, and I think one thing that we need to highlight as well is much as some of our members might be important, over time, in the natural evolution of companies, some of these small BEE companies will scale up and move into production. And certainly the experience of a Cipla Metro, a Ranbaxy, and Aurobindo now shows this is exactly what tends to happen. Our members are very active in skills development, in technology acquisition. We employ people, and I think one of the issues that has been mentioned in IPEP around pharmaceuticals is the fact that by supporting local manufacturing jobs will be created. I think that's a myth that will debunk. What I want to say at this point is that a lot of these companies that also import medicines employ a lot of people in their sales and marketing operations, in finance and admin. Manufacturing in pharma is high tech and doesn't employ that many people. certainly our members are supportive of government initiatives, specifically around things like the health charter and economic transformation. As I said, I'm not going to dwell on the next two slides. You know this. I think what you just want to say here is the NAPM is supportive of the work that government has done today. We hope that, you know, consultation would be right. It would have been a little bit more widespread. But certainly we support the work that has been done. Now, if I come to ICAP 2 and just to talk to our understanding of the issue, we understand that beyond just the industrial imperative, the aim is also to assist the government in realizing the objectives of making medicines more accessible and affordable, obviously in line with Section 27 of the Constitution as well as the National Drug Policy. Now, clearly, we also understand that the aim is to encourage investment and the development of the pharmaceutical industry as a whole. I must stress that, not at least in that company. And certainly, the ultimate aim is to contribute to the growth of the SA economy. Now, we have here some key points that we've taken out of the document. We've added, or it's highlighted in red, these are some of the issues that the NAPM feel would be important to incorporate into the final document. Certainly when you talk about issues like alignment with the broad-based black economic empowerment, industrial policy, we have added health policy there. I think that mention has been made of the disconnect sometimes between industrial and health policy, or the very uneasy tension between those two. Access, access, access. So health policy has to be a part. Certainly we believe that any reform should be aimed at increasing exports. That's how you increase competitiveness. And we believe that a lot of work should be done in trying to obviously assist the regulator to fast track the registration of medicines, because greater competition, lower costs, more access. Now, if I can just move to some of the concerns, serious concerns that we have with the document and some of the issues that have been raised around this document. One of the key issues raised constantly is that ICAP will contribute substantially towards an improvement in the trade balance. Experience and independent research shows that the trade balance for pharma, chemicals and pharma has been fairly consistent since 1994. And certainly given the fact that the bulk of the finished drug product is API, the raw material, is almost exclusively imported. We believe that even if finished formulations were targeted, there would be very little impact. If anything, the contribution of chemicals or pharmaceuticals to the trade deficit will shift from finished formulations to the API, because we will still have to import that API anyway. One of the key issues that has been raised consistently is, of course, around how, this is number five, the number five contributor, and of course the role of India in all of this. Mention has been mentioned specifically of how India is now the number two exporter to South Africa. I think it has to be said, if we dig a little deeper, you'll realize that India provides the bulk of the antiretrovirals to South Africa. Whether it's finished formulation, whether it's the raw material that companies use locally to formulate the finished product, the bulk of it comes from India. And naturally, given the rapid scale-up of the national HIV/AIDS program, it is not surprising that imports from India have increased dramatically. And by the way, a lot of our member companies import from the EU, from Europe, but for some reason this is never highlighted. It's always about India and Asia. And I think later on in the presentation, one will try and speak to some issues that explain why perhaps India is so competitive. One of the great myths that's propagated in some sectors is that ICAP will create significant jobs in the manufacturing sector. The pharmaceutical industry is a highly automated, high-tech industry. If you go to India and look at a typical Indian company, a Cipla, Rembesi, a Lupin, you'll find that they have in the region of about 1,400 people in research and development, 300-400 of whom will have PhDs in pharmaceutical science, analytical chemistry, organic chemistry, and of course even down to the production level, you have very highly skilled people. So the idea that if you favor local manufacturing, you'll suddenly create a lot of jobs is totally, totally false. I think the other issue, and I mentioned this in my opening, companies that import finished products are also significant contributors to the economy. If I look at the NAPM membership, our members employ something in the region of about 2,000, 2,005 members.
These people are employed in sales and marketing, in admin, in the distribution system. So the notion that a lot of the importers are 5-8 men operations with a black person manning the reception, not entirely true. I think the other thing is importing is a very easy entry point for historically disadvantaged people into this industry. As I said, in the natural evolution of companies, you can start importing. As you grow, as you build scale, you then move into manufacturing. It might initially be contract manufacturing, but then companies go on to certainly set up their own plants. My own company has a facility in Devon. You've got companies like Grandex and Aurobindo that have also gone that route. Another issue that has been raised is that IPEP would obviously lead to significant import replacement. Once again, if you break down the finished product, if you take a particular drug, an antiretroviral for example, you'll find that between 70 and 90% of that finished product is imported raw material. There's almost virtually no API manufacturing in the country. Yes, you have things like codeine and hydrochlorothiazide, but very little API manufacturing. So to suggest that by formulating locally, we will somehow deal with this trade balance and will ensure security of supply is false. Security is in the API. That is where security is. Now, just to give you a practical example, the largest pharma company last year discontinued the number of line items, penicillins and all of that. And I think part of the reason might have been the fact that they do not have access to their own API and it's not competitive. Continuity of security of supply in pharma derives from obviously full integration, having access to your own API, being very, very efficient, ruthlessly efficient in manufacturing, which is what a lot of companies in the East have. Now, one of the issues that has also been raised before this committee and read in the media is that local manufacturers cannot compete because some countries, and India has been mentioned once again, enjoy massive government incentives. I think we need to debunk that myth and disabuse ourselves of the notion that Indian companies are competitive because of government support. Nothing can be further from the truth. The so-called export incentive advantage is really a tax rate in your export profits, and the figure we've been given is that it's around 19%. If you want to look at the real advantage of India, which has been built up over 44 decades, it's in the setup cost of manufacturing facilities, 40 to 50% lower than in Europe and in the US. It's in the cost of equipment, tooling, and all of these things are manufactured in India by Indian companies. It's in the ability to integrate. 75% of the bulk drug needs of India, API needs of India, are manufactured internally. And the bulk drug is really what goes into the finished product. Indian companies have got massive scale. 25% of the global generic drug output comes from India. In my beginning, I said we should not try and fool ourselves and think that we get scale by giving protection locally. Scale is derived from exports, from looking into the international market. The other point is, if you look at antiretrovirals, 90% of the antiretrovirals that are used in the third world are manufactured in India. The advantage of India derives from their world-class skills, PhDs, analytical chemistry, biochemistry, molecular biology, organic chemistry, pharmaceutical science. It's all there. We don't have it. In a typical company, as I said, 1,400 scientists, 300 PhDs. Give me one company in South Africa that has more than 10 PhDs. You'll struggle to find one. The other issue is, because these guys have got such powerful research and development capabilities, reverse engineering, if you will, a lot of the improvements that they will come upon in developing one drug are then distributed through their other products, further driving down production costs. That is where the advantage of India comes from. One of the issues, of course, that has been raised is that importation poses risks to the security of supply, specifically for conditions like antiretroviral. Once again, I cannot stress this point enough, security of supply is in API production. If you do not have access to API production and you think you have security of supply, you're fooling yourself. It doesn't happen like that. And certainly, if we were to go and implement some of the things that are proposed and rely heavily on a few domestic manufacturers, what will basically happen is we will threaten this very security of supply that we talk about. And I hope I'll show you a slide that speaks to some of those issues. Another issue that was raised in this forum is that IPEP legal advice has been sought and IPEP is not unconstitutional. Certainly we've received a different opinion, albeit not yet written, but we are told that if you look at Article 217, and I have highlighted some of the issues today, which talk to procurement that has to be fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective. And if you look under Section 2 there, it talks about the protection of advancement of persons or categories of persons disadvantaged by fair discrimination. If I read between the lines, what I'm seeing in the press is some people are getting unfair advantages because the government does this and that. And my point of the NHM view would be that lack of integration of scale certainly hardly qualifies as unfair discrimination. Now, if we look at some of the concerns then that we have, by default, if this point making would happen, it would confer dominance in a few locally producing companies and create artificial monopolies. One of our colleagues was able to source some figures from a recent interim results presentation from the biggest pharma company. And you'll see there that this is from their own presentation. 3 out of every ARVs in the public sector are basically provided by them, supplied by them. 1 out of 4 tablets in the public sector institutions. 1 out of every 4 or 5 scripts dispensed by pharmacies. If you give dominance to a player who already enjoys it, what are you saying for the rest of the industry? What are you saying for empowerment, for transformation, and all the things that you want? Because ultimately, competitiveness does not lie with 1 big player or 2 or 3 big players. It lies in a ruthlessly competitive industry. India has 20,000 units. You know, the biggest player in India has probably 5.4% market share. The 10 biggest companies control 40% of the market. The biggest 200 companies control 70% of the market, and then you have another 7,000 or 8,000 companies sharing the rest. Every single product you'll find 50 or so, 20 to 50 suppliers, if not more. That is what you need if you want to drive the price of medicines down. And I think our focus should be on access, affordability. If you go into an HR, these things will be critical. The one point I also want to highlight, we spoke about the natural evolution of companies. If you're saying, because you're not manufacturing locally, you're out, what does it mean for a big player who aspires to one day be as big as some of the big players? Because in the natural evolution of companies, you start small, you build up scale, eventually you go into manufacturing, research, and all these good things. That is what has happened with Indian companies. You can go and look at companies that started in 84, Aurobindo 89, Lupin 84. Where are they now? They are now with original research and development. That is what happens in the natural evolution of companies. I think certainly one of the concerns, and I've said this ad nauseam, but the importance lies in API. We cannot say we control this industry if we don't have API. And the document talks about protecting local manufacturers. What is this manufacturing we're talking about? Just to give an example of what we mean when we talk about access and affordability, we've drawn some figures from a very recent tender. This is the contraceptive tender that was awarded recently by government towards the end of last year. Now, the biggest player in the country, they've had this tender for quite a while. Dr. Reddy's is one of our member companies, and he has the import finished product. If you look at that, you see that the biggest player in the country, manufacturing locally, we are told, came in at 481. Dr. Reddy's have supplied the same product to the state at 259. If we look at another product, Nodet, Dr. Reddy's came in at 2.63, almost 50% of the 526 that the biggest company, the landed cost that they supply to the state. This is what access is all about, because the more you drive this cost down, the more you increase the food who access this benefit. Certainly, this picture can be replicated with antiretroviral, antihypertensive, you know. So, now, one other concern, point making, an unintended consequence, we believe, would be that if a local supplier knows that they'll get the second bite as a cherry, there's nothing that would incentivize them to come with the best price in the first place. At the same time, there's a very real danger that companies that want to come out and supply will decide that, why bother? What does it do to competition? Because this is one of the central tenets of this document, competition, competition. And of course, from us as an APM, the issue of access is key. What does it do to access if suddenly small players withdraw from this market because they know that someone will be given a second chance? We, in terms of the impact, we see some very, very worrying things there. Of course, we already mentioned the fact that you create artificial monopoly. This invariably leads to reduced access, obviously. Now, for a country that is betting to meet our millennium development goals, for a country whose life expectancy is going down, this would be very dangerous. We must accept, I think it's Ralph Waldo Emerson who says, health is the first wealth. Productivity of a country depends on a healthy population. The MDGs already show where we are. Now, if you're going to reduce this access further, certainly, this will not be good for our country. The next slide basically, sorry, I seem to have missed one slide. The next slide basically talks to what we feel are the requirements for a successful IPEP implementation. The support has got to be for the whole industry. And we would even argue, as we said, there are small and medium enterprises, black-owned companies that are trying to enter this market. And certainly, if that support does not flow through with the kind of incentives that we've seen some of the big players get in the last few years, they will never be able to enter this market and compete. Now, further going ahead to say, if you import your out, we might as well tell aspiring black businesses and SMEs, don't bother to enter this industry. We believe that the IPEP should, as its very, very, very basic, at its very basic, must promote fair and healthy competition. Because clearly, research from around the world has shown when you have robust competition, you push prices down, you improve access dramatically. We certainly believe that there should be alignment of policies and objectives relating to health, investment, capacity building and job creation. I've mentioned the unhealthy tension between industrial and health policy. I think that's something that has to be looked at very closely. We believe that it would be important to strengthen and restructure the regulator. The more drugs you register, the more drugs enter the market, the more robust your competition and the lower the price. And secondly, as I said, it's all about access, access, access. With those few words, I thank you. My colleagues and I will take any questions. And if there are issues that we haven't covered, we'll certainly submit in our written document.
Thank you very much for that input briefing that has been made. We appreciate it. Over to members, that was Dr. Skumbuza Godwana. We have Honorable Kotsi, Honorable Khadebe, Honorable Kwabasa, Honorable Marea, Honorable Mabasa. Thank you. In that order, and I think the same points apply. Let's keep it brief.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the presenter is almost aware that this policy is trying to encourage more manufacturing in this country because we have a problem with unemployment and trying to develop our industry. I am interested, therefore, to know how many people they have employed in their company. And in his input, he talked a lot about import as well, that if we do not encourage that, we will actually be limiting small businesses. I'm interested to know how much in terms of percentage of their products they import, and perhaps how much are actually
used, I mean, actually local ones, because that actually is a matter that we should take into consideration as well. And perhaps the relationship, I know these different companies are in business, it is true we've had some other pharmaceutical companies presenting here. How much relationship is there? Because for us as South Africans, that relationship is needed. And perhaps if we want more production for this country, that relationship, how small or how big companies are, but if there is that interacting and working relationship, it will assist even in terms of procuring as well, considering South African companies.
Thank you, Honorable
Kumbe Chairperson. A person will appreciate the input which is made here, because for the first time we find an almost an antithesis from what has happened in the previous week. Yeah. But what I'd like to ask the presenter is, number one, is the issue of dealing with the issue of unemployment and the security of the product which they have to provide. So one way of dealing with that is in operation management, speak with the spare part integration. They say the major ingredient in their product is the APRs, they say they are important. So will it not be wise as South Africans to produce some of those ingredients locally, so that if they are produced locally here, we create work, we also lower the price on that ingredient. In the process, the whole price goes down and then accessibility is attained. Number two, we'll go to the issue of the legal opinion which they spoke about, unconstitutional. I think that we had Professor Fiona Yewas here, that she said that there is no country in the world which has industrialized without the support of the state. Does he suggest that the state must fold its hands in this industry so that it can run its cost competitively? Because I think that we have lost competitive advantage because we left it to the private sector to run some of the key industries. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable.
Thank you,
Honorable.
Thank you, Chairperson. The first question, I don't hear the presenter making any mention of the indigenous the manufacture of indigenous herbal medicine. If you could comment on that. Secondly, Chair, by your own admission, you're saying that this the pharmaceutical industry is a highly skilled, highly knowledge-based kind of industry. I'm not certain whether I heard you when you said that, I heard you correctly when you said that it is a myth that there would be a creation of more jobs in the context of IPA. If that is what you were saying, I'm suggesting that you are not making any contribution towards the development of the skill base that is required to develop and make this industry as competitive as India and any other country that continues to be a competitive economy.
Thank you, Honourable Maria.
Thank you, Chair. It was actually very good to hear the submission from the other side. To hear both sides. Obviously, in your my assumption is that in your case, you're obviously looking from a business point of view and making your product more affordable for the consumers. I just failed to see in here how that in itself will grow the economy. Because I think one of the things of some of the things in IPAC too is supposed to be earning foreign currency, because we've got a balance of payment problem and a deficit problem, and to create jobs. In other words, to broaden the tax base, the revenue base for government, obviously to be able to spend more money on all of these things. I I haven't picked that up. Maybe that is not just the emphasis of yours, but I haven't seen that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Maria, Honourable Mavanta.
Thank you very much. I must express appreciation to the professor. The one first question is what contribution in terms of skills is your sector making into the economy? I would take that that should be something that should be done in conjunction with then what three main ingredients do you think if you were to say these are the three do's that EPUB must do, which three will you start with? And which three will you say these are the do's? And then the last one, do we think that the public sector and government has a critical role to play in the economy, or do we think it must play a lesser role? And I must once more express appreciation and hope that we will have more.
Thank you very much. I think the question on the number of workers in the industry, etc., was asked, but there was one slide or comment with reference which, to different companies involved in the, I think the membership of the organisation, and the one reference was of course multinationals, which in passing you did also refer to. What would be useful is if we look at that one of those slides, we have to guess which one it was, if you were able to just give us a little bit of a breakdown. We've got these two or three on the one side that are internal, and then the, if you like, the external or multinational company, which is probably also based here, in subsidiary. What would be the rough kind of percentage, ballpark figure that we'd be looking at with the what the outputs are financially the company generates, that's the multinationals in relation to the others, and then also the cost benefits in relation to the drugs that are procured, including the amount of labour that is employed. The third question would be to perhaps pose questions which we have to others, and that is we have a declining industrial base. This is why we've got the IPAC, trying to accelerate it. And we were made aware that, I think it was Korea, if I'm not mistaken, didn't have a, what was it, a shipbuilding industry. Had nothing. But lucky they had a sort of a coastline to get, actually create it. I wonder why they were able, or how they were able, to go into a brand new field when, in fact, at that time, there were two other major countries which would offer them such extreme competition. And yet today, I understand, I haven't seen the figures yet, they have a very, very competitive shipbuilding industry. So I'm putting that to you. You may not have sufficient time to respond to the last question, but I'm sure the other questions I've put here would have been part and parcel of what has already been asked. Over to yourself.
I will deal with the first issue around, I think what was raised was the issue of employment, what percentage imported, locally produced and whatnot. Let me say that front that we believe that there should be a balance. We as we said, if you look at our vision, we talk about developing the South African pharmaceutical industry as a national asset.
And like I said, amongst our members, we've got companies that have got their own production facilities. Some have invested 250, 300 million in their facilities. So certainly, the issue of local production is important. We are for that. But what we're calling for is a balance. And we see a danger in saying, because you are not manufacturing locally, there's this potential that you will not be able to get state tender business. If a locally manufacturing company then gets a second bite as you will, as a carry. What we are saying, contrary, is that if you look at the natural evolution of companies, you start small, strategic relationships overseas, you start selling, you build up some revenue, some profitability. Then as the company evolves, you go into first